Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are in paper 52, section 3, which is old single column, page 592. All right, okay, so remember last session we did the previous section on post-planetary prince men, and they pointed out that it's really the planetary prince's job to definitively foster the beginnings of personality expression. Remember, he's the civilizational uplifter. Civilization is a choice. It's not something that happens just because you're an animal origin creature. So he's fostering things moving from that more natural manifestation of tribes with their folkways, you know, moving into the beginnings of nations with their mores. There's, you know, some blending, but not a lot that goes on of the races. Most of the blending is going to happen in this next dispensation of the planetary prince's supervision. But remember how that section ended with those four paragraphs, very vigorously, very ruggedly, explaining the basic genetics issues that definitely the prince is beginning to work on, and the Adam and Eve pick up where you know, the prince and his staff leave off on that, because in order to get that more definitive personal expression happening, just as an individual, you can't be bogged down by lots of genetic issues, you know, defects in your genetic nature that's going to fundamentally break the symmetry potential of your mind. The only way for your personality to manifest is if you have a measure of wholeness that has formed in your mind. Your personality can't manifest through some part, like, you know, half-hearted sorts of things, right? I mean, are of no avail. You definitely need to deal with those genetic issues in terms of the individuals, not to mention then you're going to try to manifest a collective expression of personality, and the same thing is there. If you have individuals that disrupt the harmonizable potential of the group, there's just, you're never going to get anything very profound out of that group. Doesn't matter how hard you try. They fundamentally break the integrity potential of that group. So, you remember how we talked about how, you know, they mentioned that we can't really imagine what it's like on a normal world, even after that that first son's efforts. At the end of that second dispensation, because, you know, you've done so much work on improving the genetics and stuff relative to what we understand, that that, you know, it's just just really beyond our comprehension, you know, what it would be like to be on a world that was in that state, and remember the most poignant aspect of that was that there's almost no fear left in humans at the end of the that post-planetary prince age. You know, that you have such definitive human expression that self-mastery just kind of naturally handles fear. And definitely, by the time you get to the end of the post-Adamic age you're about to read about, I mean, basically fear, any sort of a fear-based social expression, you know, let alone a fear-based religious expression, is a thing in the rearview mirror. It's a thing of the past. You know, so that's just really hard for us to imagine, you know, living on a world that doesn't fundamentally, you know, isn't fundamentally bogged down by that issue of fear, one way or another. You know, in interpersonal relationships and everything, you know, nation relationships and everything else. Okay, so as we go through the rest of these dispensations, you'll see they will occasionally mention the genetic issue. It's an ongoing thing, even well into light and life. You know, there's no crude genetic problems anymore, but you can always tweak things better, right? You know, the genetics in a world of light and life, again, is completely beyond our imagination in terms of being, quote-unquote, perfect, you know, relative to what we can imagine. And yet they're still thinking, well, there's, you know, there's great and then there's even greater, you know, and we want to foster the greater and, you know, de-emphasize the merely great. You know, they continue to tease through genetic engineering everything they can get out of, you know, human potential. Okay. So let's look at this.
Before you go on, you mentioned fear a second.
Yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember this. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is no spirit of fear, so to speak.
Right.
When you get to the mansion worlds, you don't take animal fear with you, do you? Do you remember
what they say about that? You know, your soul does embody the sort of the essence of your animal nature still, you know, in its, because of its limited aspect. I mean, you aren't going to literally be using adjutant mind, so you can't literally do the fear thing like we think of the fear thing, because you don't
even say there's nothing to fear.
Yeah, you don't have adjutant mind, right? And that definitely the, you know, there's no carnivores roaming around or anything like that, right? Now, of course, there aren't physical wars, but, you know, there was a quote-unquote war in heaven, right? You know, so there are things that, you know, might stress you, okay? But you won't respond in an animal fear mode. But you will respond in an imbalanced way that, trying to think how to describe that, you know, that would be the equivalent of fear, you know, in some way. Like, remember I was mentioning, don't forget that basically the whole, in the hourglass analogy of your mindful self, that whole lower domain is really in many ways a fear domain. I mean, fear directly is the zeroth level of meaning, but the first and second level of meanings down there are just exalted expressions of that basal fear. On the first level, you have anguish and dread, and on the second, you have awe and reverence. You know, and so even that final one of reverence, the word itself, the root of the word reverence is fear. You know, and so it literally means, you know, fear again, you know, a new and improved fear is literally, you know, the etymology of the word reverence. Right? So you will have, the equivalent, because you're obviously going to have the equivalent of reverence, if nothing else, up there.
You eventually get through, I might imagine.
Right. But eventually you will get beyond, I mean, that's the whole point of the Mansion Worlds, is to leave behind all of that animal vestigial, you know, sort of stuff. Right?
Yep. Did you say it's more just doubt?
Right, there's obviously doubt. I mean, but you know, remember, you're trying to get to a mind expression that's kind of similar to, initially, you know, you're trying to get to a mind expression that's similar to a seraphim's mindal self, you know, and they don't have fear.
Right.
Yeah, but it takes you a while to get over, just like I was just saying, I mean, basically, just exalted modes of mind function that are effectively exalted fear.
Do you think that war in heaven is what took so many people down? Is that they, prior to that, they had complete trust in the administration and the functioning. But with Lucifer, he introduced doubt into that.
Well, I mean, the main reason that anyone joins a rebellion is because they lack consecration of mind to the Universal Mother. They lack cosmic integrity. Every one of those beings that's joining a rebellion, no matter how high or low the being is a person, and you know, and they can consecrate their will just as definitively as the next person. Yeah, but the issue is fundamentally whether or not you have the requisite wisdom, insight, and foresight to overcome, you know, any sort of deceptive or seductive appearance. Right?
It's so hard to imagine that seraphim or midwayers or anyone like that would have. Would be incapable of seeing through that. But it really speaks to his ability to orate.
Yes, and don't underestimate, remember, yes, they've got the Holy Spirit, like we do, but we have a catalytic agent in our mind.
Right.
It helps us to use that insight better, a thought adjuster.
Spirit of truth.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, yeah. Just focusing on that one issue of, you know, having the requisite insight to penetrate through an appearance and see it for what it really is.
Right.
Right. You know, your adjuster juices that up, you know, and you can penetrate a thicker fog because of it. You know, it's like giving you fog lights. Right. You know, you're still basically using the Holy Spirit to get the recognition you need. But it's just being amplified, you know. So even if they hadn't fused, if they were a Gerasim citizen, you know, they were immune to it. They, you know, everyone went, yeah, right, sure, really. You got to be kidding me, because that adjuster, you know, boosted that ability to penetrate through his sophistry. But midwayers and angels and whatnot, you know, don't have that boosting mechanism. So if they haven't you know, taken delight in cultivating, having enough of that just on their own, you know, like Van had enough without an adjuster, he could penetrate through it, see it for what it was, but Nod didn't. Yep.
Yeah, I think what's hard for me to conceive is those are important distinctions that need to be made. And it seems, is there not at least a little anxiety that I'll make the wrong choice? You know, I mean, I can't, it's hard to conceive that I will have to make those kinds of decisions without having some anxiety that I'll make the wrong.
Yeah, see, that's, you know, that's the thing, like I was just mentioning, it's so hard for us to imagine being able to think without those disrupting influences from our primitive animal origin nature, right? To you know, to have limitations, but you aren't really like going tilt like we do. You're relatively balanced, but you're just too low. You know, whereas we'll be too low and tilted, right? As, you know, any fear or anger, or anything like that, tips the whole equilibrium, throws you out of equilibrium. Whereas these other beings are kind of naturally, more balanced, but they just may be too short-sighted, too shallow, whatnot.
The creative Mother Spirit is the one that creates the seraphim and all the angels.
Mm-hmm.
So, are they just not able to see above her that there would be a God? There is a God, like he was trying to say there wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Again, don't forget how the adjuster boosts your third cosmic intuition to make it all the more definitive to you what that insight is trying to tell you, that there's a God. Again, they don't have that. And, none of them have been to the Isle of Paradise. They have to just take someone's word for it. They're in the same mode that humans are. Humans go, well, I don't see a God. I think this is just a bunch of baloney. But again, see, because they're sort of naturally kind of limited, if someone tells them there's a God, they'll go, okay, and they just go with that, never really question it. They're kind of like Alpheus twins on steroids, right, in some ways. They're very trusting and just kind of accepting and kind of go with the flow. But you're setting yourself up. It's like, well, what if you got to stand on your own 2 feet a little bit? They can't do it very well. They're just made that way. And, eventually they do get to an integrous level. But without that, catalyzing agent, that activating agent of an adjuster, it takes them a very, very long time to build up enough wisdom, insight, and foresight to be able to stand on their own. Whereas we can do it in relatively short period of time. I mean, from here to Gerasim and boom, I've got much more, insight than they have after hundreds of millions, hundreds of billions of years.
Who gives the seraphim their orders?
You've got the whole hierarchy, remember, of seraphim, and going all the way up to Gabriel.
Isn't the resident governor general casting it down?
Well, if you're on the planet here, but he was just talking in the universe at large.
I didn't mean to get us off topic.
No, no.
I just wondered how they could do that when they're all the way up there and where they come from. It's just so strange.
Yeah.
Me.
Would you just talk a little bit about how it can possibly be that you can have, all I can do is use an example. You have three children. One of them is so loving, so giving, can't imagine, and has no connection whatever to the Urantia book or to the Urantia book teachings, but is the most spiritual person you can imagine. Not necessarily Buddhist, just from the heart. You have another one who is a Urantia book fundamentalist and is a pain, a pill, for instance. You have another one who's very agnostic, very successful in life, very loving, but can't embrace the Urantia book. What is it that makes such a diversity of people who embrace this teaching?
Well, okay, and for those of you on the webinar, she's pointing out, why exactly can there be such a profound diversity of people, just using the illustration, relative to recognizing or relating to the fifth epical revelation? Again, remember, you can puzzle over this diversity if you're thinking in terms of, if everyone is a person, has this sort of equality of personal nature from the Universal Father, why is there greater equality? But again, it's just like what we're talking about here. none of us in this room are manifesting much personal nature at all. We're just fancy animals, by and large, and we have, you know, a certain temperament, a certain nature, you know, based upon our genetics. And just like we were talking about, that genetics is all over the map. It has all kinds of different blind spots or accentuations. You know, you have a natural ability in some area and hopeless in some other area. See, and none of that has anything to do with personality. You know, that's all just the temperament of your mind or self. You know, and in general, there are no positive mindful selves. Every mindful self has issues. We might say that certain ones are better than others and have less issues than others and stuff, but that's not the case. I mean, it doesn't matter how much, you know, you might say this mindful self is spiritual and therefore doesn't have as many issues or something. No, that actually can be a bigger problem than someone that isn't so quote-unquote spiritual. Because, you know, remember, when you're just talking the mindful self, you know, it just means that they favor their unity consciousness in their mindful self. That doesn't have anything to do with whether or not they have an improved relationship with the Holy Spirit. Just because I favor the sixth adjutant doesn't make me have better relationship with the Holy Spirit. The only way to get to the Holy Spirit from the sixth adjutant is through the seventh adjutant. It's through my philosophic impulse, right? Right, and so, you know, see, and that fundamentally has a symmetry. You know, in order to get to the Holy Spirit at all, you need a symmetry. And, you know, and if you're biased in any way, and like I just said, every one of us mindful selves is biased in some way. So none of us can access the Holy Spirit very much. That's the whole point of what the Prince's staff is trying to do. You got all these mindful selves, and none of them can really get to personal stuff. None of them can really access the Holy Spirit because they're lopsided, right? And they've got to work on sort of just weeding out through attrition, and, you know, if nothing else, all of the influences that are lopsided like that. Until more and more, the humans are just naturally kind of symmetric. You know, and then Adam and Eve come with a very symmetrizing or whatever, an influence that tends to make it more symmetric. They boost the seventh adjutant. Okay, so that's just all it is. I mean, it's just a matter of humbly recognizing that all of us are struggling in one way, and don't be satisfied with your initial sensibilities of things.
My question has to do is specifically with this revelation.
Well, again, I mean, really it's the same answer. I mean, remember, this is a philosophic text. Unless you're going to relate to it in some very limited way, if you're going to relate to it in any sort of a holistic way, you've got to have some sort of symmetric sort of consciousness. Or it just won't speak to you. You got to be curious. A lot of animal origin creatures shaped like this are not very curious.
You're not.
Right. It's just all these things. Yeah.
But they have PhDs.
Get that animal fear out of there. Don't worry.
Most PhDs are hopelessly biased.
They make you curious.
Right. I mean, they're called doctors of philosophy, but they aren't. Right.
They're not curious.
Right, I mean, no, I mean, they're just have an advanced technical degree.
Okay.
It's a historical, leftover that there's that title of Doctor of Philosophy attached to those people. Yeah. Right, they don't have a philosophic mind at all.
Such a mystery to me to try to introduce this and work so hard on it over the years. And to see the reactions from the personalities that are so different.
Mm-hmm.
Some are repelled. Very few are magnetized.
Are drawn to it, yeah.
Drawn to it.
don't give up.
Extrapolate the philosophical concepts and then present those in the current milieu of the Bible and whatever else. I mean, that's.
But what's the difference in the people? What is, what makes the difference in the people?
Yeah, okay, let's get to the content here. All right.
Post-Adamic man. When the original impetus of evolutionary life has run its biologic course, when man has reached the apex of animal development, there arrives a second order of sonship, and the second dispensation of grace and ministry is inaugurated. This is true on all evolutionary worlds. When the highest possible level of evolutionary life has been attained, when primitive man has ascended as far as possible in the biologic scale, a material son and daughter always appear on the planet, having been dispatched by the system sovereign.
Okay, let me just give you a little bit beyond this paragraph so that you can better appreciate this. You know, there's other spots in the book that expand on this more. So when the original impetus of evolutionary life has run its biologic course, when man has reached the apex of animal development, there arrives a second order of sonship. Okay, what exactly are they talking about? Okay, it's important to notice that it's not the apex of human development they're talking about here. It's the apex of animal development. Okay, there's before there can be any significant human development, you have to finish the animal development of man. We're not talking about animals, we're talking about humans, but the animal development of humans. And the simplest way to think about it is with the hourglass analogy. Right? There's two domains. You've got to, you know, build up the lower domain first before you can really significantly build up the upper domain. That lower domain of animal development, right, is predicated on your genetics. The upper domain of human development is predicated on coming into relationship with the cosmos. Okay. So that one, and that results from choice, taking the light and cultivating, right? I mean, consecrating yourself upward to the cosmos. But the animal development is just the natural evolutionary process bubbling up. Okay, and there are three phases that this adjutant ministry goes through. Remember, adjutant mind is over controlling the evolution. So there's an initial phase where adjutant mind is engaging biologic organisms on the planet and encouraging it upward, upward. Until you get the first two humans. And let's just consider our world because it's so nice and clean without, you know, all the races spread out, you know, over time and stuff. We just have the first two will creatures, you know, and so that transition is very clean in our world from the first phase to the second phase. When you get the first two will creatures, adjutant mind goes into its second phase, its second mode of functioning on the world. No longer will it continue to foster the upward movement where an animal crosses the threshold to human nature. It turns that off. It will continue to drive things up towards the boundary, but it won't drive them across the threshold up to human nature anymore. And it also then obviously focuses in on the humans now, the will creatures, and continues to foster them upward. So that's the second phase. That's the phase that you're in, that second phase, with the post-planetary prince age. And they're just talking about, you finally get to the point where all of the animal stock that can be brought pre-human has been, you know, it's been brought up as high as it can, without crossing the threshold. And the human stock itself has been brought up as high as it can go in and of itself. And when you, there's no potential left. A lot of people like to imagine there's some, you know, there's thousands or millions of years of evolution still ahead of us or something. No. You know, back before Adam and Eve came, all of that potential was actualized. There's none left. Okay? All the animal development potential has been actualized. And there'll won't be any more, you know, no matter how many billions of years it goes on this planet. Okay? We're talking about reaching that apex, see, right here. And then the adjutant mind goes into a third phase, a phase it's in right now, where it's maintaining things. It's no longer in that mode where it's, you know, it's fostering an upward movement. It's just maintaining what has been built. Now, remember with those other possible species that are brought right up close to human nature, on our world we had 7,000 like that that were biologically compatible. There was all kinds of backmating, you know, the Andonites with those other stocks, but none of them were human. Because the adjutants weren't in that mode where they brought them up across the human threshold, but it brought them right up to the point where biologically they were compatible.
And they looked like they were humans.
You know, and they were roughly looked like, you know, the Andonites. Okay, but that there's going to be some of that probably on every world, but on our world, because it was a decimal world. You know, you had this vast amount of that that phenomenon that was separate from encouraging the will creatures upward in that second phase. You were also encouraging animals upward to their maximum. Okay, so that's the mode you're in, and so you've maximized the animal development of the humans, and then the Adam and Eve come, and so they and everyone that follows them. Is much more focused on the potentials of human development in those humans. Okay, and that should remind you again of what we were just talking about. We know that we're still a very fearful people. We've got, you know, they tell you point blank that we're, in many ways, we're still way back in these very early dispensation modes. Right, I mean, we aren't really at the point where there's a lot of human development possible yet. We've got to recognize our limitations. If there's going to be human development, you're going to have to make use of all of these spirit ministries that can do the mustard seed sort of a thing, right? Take something very limited and make it something great. You have to kind of count on that geometric potential of spirit, okay? All right, so that's what we're talking about. We're getting to that point where all of the, you know, the adjutant mind is not going to get any fancier, basically, because the biologic foundation has been maximized and the adjutant mind is attuned to that genetics. You know, the only caveat, of course, is, you know, you're literally going to, these evolutionary creatures are going to mate with the Adam and Eve, okay, and that's going to give them a genetic boost, okay? Not an evolutionary, you know, they're going to get a boost not because of an evolutionary process, but just by that fiat. Right? So obviously you could attune higher adjutant mind to that now improved body. So there's a little bit of improvement. And, you know, like we said, the main thing that you're trying to do is increase how much the seventh adjutant can engage. You know, that's the main boosting of genetics and hence mind that the material sons and daughters, or the, you know, the children of the Adam and Eve give to the people. Okay, so that's the mode we're in. I know there's been lots of confusion about this. Just notice how to defend it. When the highest possible level and reach the apex, okay? So just remember that. If someone is kind of going off on that tangent thinking there's going to be some sort of all kinds of incredible evolution of humans going forward in the future, no. The only improvements that are going to come is not going to be from evolution. It's going to come from genetic engineering. Right, because you've already done all the evolution. It's done. All right. So we got our Adam and Eve dispatched by the system sovereign, and we're off to the next races. What are they up to next?
Thought adjusters are increasingly bestowed upon the post-Adamic man. And in constantly augmented numbers, these mortals attain capacity for subsequent adjuster fusion. While functioning as descending suns, the atoms do not possess adjusters, but their planetary offspring, direct and mixed, become legitimate candidates for the reception in due time of the mystery monitors. By the termination of the post-Adamic age, the planet is in possession of its full quota of celestial ministers. Only the fusion adjusters are not yet universally bestowed.
Okay, so that improvement is having this effect. Now, there's also, in ways they don't describe, you've got this improved environment, too, this improved energy environment in this subsequent dispensation. But we talked about this before. See, here's where they're stating it explicitly, that you start out, it's almost all spirit fusers when it's primitive man. And then you go to the planetary prince's age, and you're going to get a few more that are going to be father fusers. And here they're pointing out even more now are going to be father fusers in the post-Adamic age. But there still are going to be some spirit fusers. But obviously by the end of the Adamic age, you should have pretty much left all of that really rudimentary stuff behind. You have a pretty definitive personal potential creature, in play now. And that's one of the reasons why they can only be spirit fusers, because they're just very limited in their capacity, right? I mean, the ability of personality to engage and have any sort of a definitive relationship to the spirit ministries or anything like that. Okay, so you're going to have more angels coming because you've got more individuals. Now, the one little thing to remind you, notice they said, they pointed out how the atoms do not possess adjusters, but their planetary offspring, direct and mixed, become legitimate candidates for reception in due time. Okay, so remember, I've mentioned this before. If you have a parent that has an adjuster, the child can get an adjuster at roughly age 6.
Can and will.
But obviously, Adam and Eve don't have adjusters, right? So when they have children, right, those 6-year-olds don't automatically get adjusters. Right? Remember, we have an actual discussion of that with the story of Cain and Abel. Right? Cain got his adjuster, remember, subsequent to the whole problem with Abel. Because he was 20, right? He had reached the age of choice. We've talked about that. See, he had the ability to now function in a very individualized, definitive, personal way. Okay, and he did that, and he got an adjuster. But that reminds you, Abel, who's only 18 at the time, it's pretty hard to imagine he had an adjuster. I mean, definitively he didn't, I think. Right? Right. So when Cain killed him, that's it. Abel's gone. Abel doesn't have a soul. Right?
Might have been spirit.
No. Doesn't have a soul. What are you going to spirit fuse with? I mean, Abel didn't have an adjuster. You know, that's most likely why, you know, his brother Seth was so motivated to start this religious thing, because he knew his brother was gone. You know, he was very motivated to encourage his people, you know, to focus on something besides, you know, herds and crops, right? And killing enemies and whatnot. To bring some religious consciousness into play. Right? I mean, one would assume that Abel did not have an adjuster. Okay? So, you know, that's, you know, the way of the transgressor is hard. You know, I mean, Adam and Eve had to, you know, had to endure, you know, some really definitive heartbreak. You know, not only did they have to watch all their children, you know, be carted off, you know, most of them be carted off, but then Abel, you know, it's just a very definitive reminder of what happens when you do what they do. Okay, all right, so anyway, but, so you have that for the, you know, the children of Adam and Eve, but, you know, you also have the possibility for humans, you know, like they're, you know, as they're pointing out there, you could still have humans that don't automatically have a thought adjuster and hence have a soul. I mean, if, for instance, this is a pretty rough time still. You know, what if you're two and mom and dad are killed? Okay? All right? This isn't post-Pentecost. You're going to get your thought adjuster automatically like you do now. Right? You're on your own. Right? You're going to hit age six. You're not going to automatically get an adjuster. You're going to have to work your way up to some point of getting an adjuster, one of those prerequisites of adjuster indwelling. You know, not to mention on our world with all the backmating and stuff, and so you've got all these kind of limited humans, you've got whole lineages that, you know, that basically don't have adjusters. You know, and every once in a while there's a kind of an exceptional individual, and he might be able to bootstrap himself out of the morass of his, you know, genetic lineage and get himself an adjuster, you know, and then his children will be able to get an adjuster. Yeah. But the normal sort of thing where the first pair of humans are cut above the subsequent ones so that they definitively get adjusters, they're definitively father fusers even. Right? That means when they have children, their children get adjusters, and you can start these spiritual lineages where everyone is, you know, it's like effectively it's post-Pentecost. But there's those technicalities. It isn't literally. Right? Right now, no child is dependent upon their parent to get an adjuster. Right?
On this one.
Because of spirit of truth. Right? All right, so you know, if Abel had been killed post Pentecost, Abel would have been okay because he would have gotten an adjuster at age six. But you know, not back then.
But even if you get an adjuster in this world, you still might be a spirit fuse candidate, correct?
Right now, remember they tell you that you basically have all advanced and supreme adjusters.
Yeah, true.
I mean, the spirit of truth boosts things so that. Even, you know, technically you might be still be a quite primitive human and would, you know, without Pentecost, you would be a spirit fuser, but not anymore. Now, you see, the spirit of truth is making up for your primitiveness, you know, and you get, an advanced adjuster instead, and you're a father fuser. And it overcomes all of these issues, right? Yep.
What you were talking about before with the, back mating, and then you got people dropping below the human mark.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know in the book somewhere it says the enormously increasing amount of, it's talking about today,
right,
of the subnormal.
Yeah.
Is that referring to those lineages that just never made it up to the human level?
Well, see, that was one, you know, we talked about that basically last time in the previous section. You know, see,
oh,
it was bringing up that, you know, we noticed that they were referring to, you know, not just limited humans, but literally subhumans.
What you see in a lot of, it's just not in the Urantia, but you see it in a lot of other philosophies, you know, these New Age philosophies, and there's a pulling away, you know, of what you just described, and then this subnormal. So it's you know, it's going to be kind of, anxiety for some, you know.
Yeah, and I mentioned last time, they use the word subnormal in two different ways in the book. One way is horizontally, and the other way is vertically. And when they use it vertically, like up there in paper 113, when they're talking about guardian angels, subnormal means subhuman. Okay, but when they use it in the civilization papers, and they're talking about it horizontally, subnormal, normal, and supernormal, not vertically but horizontally. And what I was just describing, that everyone in this room has serious genetic limitations and hence serious limited ability to function personally. In many ways, we're all subnormal in that horizontal sense.
Even though we have adjusters.
Right, even though we have all that.
Limited ability to make contact, because you have to be balanced on a tip, so to speak.
But again, we have the spirit of truth, and everyone has the thought adjusters, but that doesn't change the genetics. You know, we still all have limited genetics. And so getting access to those three spirit ministries, Holy Spirit, Spirit of Truth, Thought Adjuster, does not happen very naturally. You know, it's much more definitively a artificial, right, a choice thing on this world because of our limited genetics. If we were more normal genetically, a lot of that kind of would happen much more naturally. You'd have a much more natural encirclement in the Holy Spirit than we do. We just have this sort of very minimal, and you've got to do everything else beyond that minimum by taking delight and cultivating. It's just basically not going to happen much naturally.
That's a good thing.
When all is said and done, that's a great thing. You know, that's what Ag and Donders are all about and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Right? You know, exercising choice in areas that normal humans don't have to. You know, outside of Havona, now that's what it's all about. You know, you don't have to exercise any choice in Havona to have all this stuff. It all just is given to you. Outside of Havona, you have to exercise choice. Some a little bit, some a lot. You know, and if you have to exercise a lot, you're called an Ag and Donner. Right? That's the whole point. All right.
It's your lot.
It's your lot
in
life.
Could it be, Chris, that maybe they're in Havona, they're exercising choice by habit. The other not exercising, because the light's always on in paradise.
Right, yeah. Don't misinterpret me. I didn't mean they weren't exercising choice. They just don't have to exercise choice to get the basic nature all in play. Right. Right.
A slouch.
They start where we end, right, in exercising choice.
Yeah, they don't know what being a slouch is.
Right.
You know, being lazy.
All right. Let's see. Anything else? I think we got it all there. All right. So there's that issue that you're... like I said, by the termination of this post-Adamic age, the planet is in possession of a full quota of celestial ministers. So just kind of keep that in mind. That's, like I said, these second and third dispensations, technically, right, the planetary prince and the Adamic, that's really the precursor age. I mean, after that, you've got basically the whole celestial... help on the planet, and the humans are up to speed, you know, and then you can really, you know, get going on bigger issues, you know, sort of less local issues. You've kind of overcome all of the local issues of your planet, and now you're really going to consecrate yourself to being part of the cosmos. Right? But until that, you know, it's hard to be relating to the cosmos because you're still so localized and limited. Did you have, something on the webinar? Okay.
There's two questions. Okay. Gladys asks, why could Abel not go to the nursery?
Um, Right. I mean, there is this issue, what we talked about when we talked about the planetary nursery. I mean, there, it's hard to know exactly how that works. In terms of what's considered to be effectively still probationary nursery age, even though it isn't literally, like, you know, maybe you have severe genetic issues and you die at 30, but you really were only a mindful age of 5 or something. You know, we talked about maybe they get to go to the probationary nursery too. The thing is, Abel is, he's got really good genetics, and, I won't close the door definitively. But remember that the individuals who never get an adjuster, even though they're humans, and so they when they die, they just die. They don't go on as an individual. Those are part of the Supreme's evolution. And if you just think about it, the Supreme is a totalization of all the different possibilities within the finite. You can imagine, right, that some of the Supreme comes from children of material sons and daughters who never get an adjuster, right? That's probably how part of the Supreme is, evolves. So, all right, there's another question.
Winston's asking, exercising choice is meaning? What is really exercising choice in the mind, in the heart, in the habits, etc.?
Well, there's a trillion things that is exercising choice. I was just focusing on that. We have to choose our human nature, right? And on a normal world, you just kind of have your human nature, right? By grace. But we just have this very limited human nature, and to have anything significant. Remember when they talk about the spirit of truth up there in paper 34, they tell you, unless you're actively working on improving your relationship to the Holy Spirit, you basically don't have any relationship to the spirit of truth. Right? There's nothing it can do with you naturally, right? Same goes for the adjuster. You can't have any relationship to the spirit of truth and the thought adjuster unless you've increased your relationship to the Holy Spirit. You've created the capacity to have the relationship with those other two ministries. On a normal world, you naturally have the capacity to relate to those other two ministries, but not here. If you haven't taken delight in cultivating...
But you said it's the choice difference.
You've got to choose to have that adequate capacity to actually get into relationship with the thought adjuster and the spirit of truth. Okay.
It is the prime purpose of the adjuster of the Adamic regime to influence evolving man to complete the transit from the hunter and herder stage of civilization to that of the agriculturalist and horticulturalist, to be later supplemented by the appearance of the urban and industrial adjuncts to civilization. 10,000 years of this dispensation of the biologic uplifters is sufficient to effect a marvelous transformation. 25,000 years of such an administration of the conjoint wisdom of the planetary prince and the material sons usually ripens the sphere for the advent of a magisterial son.
Okay. It doesn't seem very long, does it?
No, it doesn't. Notice it's the conjoint wisdom. See how they're trying to encourage this greater relationship to wisdom. Okay, so remember how they mentioned in the post-planetary prince, he's definitively getting things going to agriculture, because he's also working on getting the family going. Remember that part? All right, so, and like I said, in many ways, these two really go together. And so... The planetary prince starts it, and Adam and Eve finish all the various processes. Same way here. Obviously, you've got a lot more with horticulture because of the garden, and bringing that part in. So you're going to have that. You're basically going to leave the hunter herder things behind when Adam and Eve are done. You know, and in our case, 25,000 BC, we would have had sufficient influence from them to affect a marvelous transformation. You know, and like I say all the time, by 10,000 BC, after 25,000 years, right, we would have had the whole enchilada, right? As they're about to describe, you know, we would have completed basically all scientific and technological development, you know, by 10,000 BC.
Does that include, you think, the Philosopher Kings portion of their
program? Discovering the force charge.
Yeah, not to mention that there would be all of these things of you know, the original plan was to, you know, to have the first generation of Adam and Eve's children mating with those material children of the prince's staff and creating those special leaders and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, which just would have, accelerated, you know, the whole process. Right? You know, I mean, but they're going to talk about it in a second. See, it's not just, like they said, it's not just getting fully to agriculture and horticulture, but because they're also bringing in science, right, you're going to get to full urban industrial, right? I mean, just picture that, 10,000 BC, you know, and it's a fully urbanized, industrialized planet and everything, right? You know?
Maybe that's why we're going so fast. I mean, right now, it seems like we're gaining quite a bit pretty quickly.
You know, we got a lot of that science in just 300 years. I mean, technically it started, you know, in the 6th century BC and, you know, finally kind of came to fruition during the Enlightenment. But, you know, it was still pretty rudimentary, you know, at the end of the Renaissance, you know. But in 300 years of the Enlightenment, boom, right? You know, we really had a lot of science going. So, you know, you've got that geometric potential of being post-Pentecost, right? Things can happen, can be accelerated by that spirit ministry, even if we're all oblivious to it. It nonetheless accelerates things.
I call it a science fiction nightmare. We're so out of sync,
right,
in the way we need to be.
We don't have all the other stuff.
Science is making it really problematic.
Right, but you're going to see that it seems like it's makes it really problematic, etc. But in another sense, it's as it's supposed to be, as we'll see here as we study this. As we go on to the next two dispensations after this one.
Just takes more elaborate philosophy to keep it all unified.
We're not totally messed up. Things are going kind of as they normally do in some ways. But like you said, I mean, unlike the, say, roughly 500,000 years for the previous one, you get this genetic boost. Okay, and you can do a lot, see, in 25,000 years. Because, again, you're giving humans access to that accelerating spirit energy. Everything can happen a lot faster.
Okay? So you think, is this what the planetary prince did when he rebelled? He tried to accelerate it, like you were just talking about, way too fast with the people who didn't even have a biological
ability. I mean, that was certainly one of the things that they were going to do. Combined with also this overemphasis on their unity consciousness, where in some ways you're saying that no improvement is needed, that everyone is innately divine. Right, that's also, you know, is in play. So, but of course that's more in play with the celestial beings. I mean, obviously, you know, he recognizes the limitations of, you know, the humans on the planet, but they were going to try to, you know, radically accelerate the process. You know, their belief was that there was way too much falderall, that it doesn't need to take that long. You know, just go at them really directly, you know, and just sort of drive them into light and life,
right.
You know.
Give them electricity right away.
Yeah, yeah. But if you try to push it too fast, you'd lose everything. Okay.
This age usually witnesses the completion of the elimination of the unfit and the still further purification of the racial strains. On normal worlds, the defective bestial tendencies are very nearly eliminated from the reproducing stocks of the realm.
Okay, just one little quick thing. See, I told you they'd give you a little mention about the eugenics.
Is it bestial or so bestial?
You can say it either way.
It's spelled like beast,
though. Right, I mean, right, but it is from beast, yes. It's just beast-like, in other words. Okay, so you see, you have the, again, like I said, Adam and Eve are sort of just completing what was started. So you have the completion of the elimination of the unfit. Okay, and that's, notice that they didn't say defective or degenerate, you know. They took the subtler one, because a lot of the defective and degenerate stuff, that was taken care of before. It's that subtler stuff that they're now completing, like we were saying. It's like, wow, the whole unfit thing, or, you know, again, everyone in the room here, myself included, right, none of us fit. Now, all of us would be candidates for limited reproduction.
Maybe sterilization. Until we get fit.
Right. Yeah, in this Adamic age, anyway, right? Because they're really getting to the point. So again, by the end of the Adamic age, you just don't have any of this issue where you're trying to have a social expression and you've got these oddballs that don't fit in. No, that doesn't exist anymore. Everyone is pretty much on the same page and fits together very naturally. See, and we love to exalt, you know, thinking it's a badge of greatness to not fit in, right? I mean, that's got some issues. You know, if there's people that don't fit in, you're a long ways away from light and life. And you can't get to light and life.
You don't mean diversity when you say don't fit
in. I don't mean diversity, but I mean, there's still a lot of diversity, but all that diversity can easily be synchronized into a system, right? When we're talking about unfit, we're talking about different in a way that is not harmonizable.
Like able to relate or not able to relate with others.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right? You're fundamentally not socializable.
Like a sociopath?
You've got sociopathic, you have social disease. That's what we're talking about with unfit. I mean, that's fundamentally, like I said, socially unfit. That's technically some measure of social disease, sociopathy. Yeah.
Talk about the steep climb that we're in for, since we're all so fit now and balanced, and yet the climb gets so steep the longer we evolve.
Yeah, and you see that, you know, this, and the still further purification. Like I said, there's even well into light and life, you can always have it be a little bit more pure than it is. They keep working on that and working on that and working on that.
And who's driving that at that point in a normal world?
Well, I mean, when Adam and Eve come, they really take over the reins from the planetary prince and his staff in terms of directing the eugenics.
For one, they can be seen.
It's right. Yeah, but it's their basic job to be the directors of the initial evolutionary eugenics. And then the subsequent artificial eugenics, you know, the genetic engineering that goes on, like I said, you know, from this point on, way into light and life, they're continuing to tweak the genetics to get it all the more properly synchronized with the cosmos. All right.
The Adamic progeny never amalgamate with the inferior strains of the evolutionary races. Neither is it the divine plan for the planetary Adam or Eve to mate personally with the evolutionary peoples. This race improvement project is the task of their progeny, but the offspring of the material son and daughter are mobilized for generations before the racial amalgamation ministry is inaugurated.
Right, so you build up an actual race before you start you know, the uplifting. You get a sort of an equal magnitude phenomenon that you know, you build it up until it has all of the diversity that it should have, right? It's a genuine race with its full natural diversity, and you're going to blend that into. Right? You don't want to start blending when you still, when you have sort of part of the race. You want the wholeness of the race to blend in. So you've got to get a significant stock of progeny built up. And notice that first line. I mean, besides us not getting a lot of biologic uplift, we also got a lot of uplifting of inferior strains. Normally, they're not, none of the inferior strains, you know, are mated with. Just to all the more accentuate them fading away, you know, into history. Well, what's the main reason? You've got this, you're going to really kind of amp up what's going on with the human, and if they're not very symmetric, you're going to amp up that asymmetry. Right? Remember how they talk about how you had, I mean, there's a lot of positive things to the Andites, but one of the negative things is they have enough of a boost to get them going very definitively. You know, they just started heading for the horizons, right? And very aggressive directional peoples. But see, they had a lot of imbalances in their nature, and so you've amped up these asymmetries. And so normally you don't do that. Normally you get things quite, you know, you've weeded out all of the oblong shaped people, right? You know, before you start amping them up, before you start lifting them up, so that when they have this greater ability, it's not flying off on a tangent. It's naturally balanced and composed. Okay, so we've got that double whammy of not getting very much and then having it fed into a lot of stock that it shouldn't have been fed into. Right, and make that stock very aggressive, and then you've got to deal with those aggressive peoples. Normally you wouldn't have such, you know, say militaristic, you know, peoples like that, amped up, biased people. Right?
Would you say that created a potential in our world, the way the situation evolved, for a lot of people like Asperger's by having this imbalance amped up in one way? I know this is labeling an Asperger's person, but this created a much greater potential for them or for someone like that?
Yeah, I mean, we have all sorts of oddball individuals, see, because of just what we're talking about, yes. I mean, you know, you can have these very extreme individuals that are, you know, very, very narrow and amped up in that little narrow area and zero everywhere else outside of that area, you know, these sorts of things. And that's just not normal. I mean, we have individuals that are so amped up that they're starting to actually use adjutant mind in ways that is more like angel-like mind than human mind. I mean, so we got really oddball stuff on this planet. Angels don't have to count the number of hairs on your head.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and we have people that don't have to count the number of things. They just know it, right?
It makes the normal world seem rather beautiful, but dull.
It reminds you, you know, the mind has direct access to matter. But normally, you know, you don't have that kind of access until you get into the mansion worlds. Right? I mean, we've got some people that, you know, and there's just almost no way for there to be any stability when you're doing that sort of stuff here. Right? That's why it's not natural here. Right? You can do those things at least relatively stably when you have Maranja mind, but to do it with agitated mind, especially agitated mind that isn't balanced, I mean, it's just you're going to have all kinds of problems.
Well, that's why philosophy is even more important in this life, because it's the strands that holds that spirit. That's those people when they don't have to count the numbers. That's short term. You know, that's short term thinking. You know, you get to the feeling part, the higher three adjectives, and then you get beyond that. It's a direct perception. It's being able to conceive broader spans of spirit, of unity spirit.
Yeah.
But they also have to be able to connect that to the people that are counting, you know, individually. You know,
Right. I mean, and just think again about how much more natural it is to be balanced when you have Maranja mind. I mean, there's only one phase of the mind you're using. All right, we have seven phases, right? And so, you know, it's not naturally balanced at all. Right? You have to somehow get those phases to function together as if it was just a single phase like Maranja mind. It doesn't happen naturally. And when you've got all of this biologic cross currents and stuff, it's almost impossible to get those adjutant ministries to work together in some symmetric way.
Maybe that's why we got this.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
So if it's never, you know, if it's not part of the plan for them to ever meet, you know, personally, then Eve and Adam, they really knew what they knew that Adam and Eve's don't mate.
Well,
and so
remember, it's not, I mean, don't overplay this. I mean, there's another spot where they explain that, you know, there are occasional exceptions on some worlds. Sometimes the Adam and Eve do. It's a very rare thing.
Okay. But still.
Here they're just saying in general. You know, what they mean by that is in general they're not supposed to mate.
What do you think?
And that's why Eve thought it would be okay, because she knows the kind of exceptions. And she's going, well, this is not a normal world. I'm not going to mate with a Sangik or an Andonite. We've got Nodites here that are basically like me. Uh-huh. Yeah. Right? So, you know, she's saying, I know actually some worlds where this has basically been done. So I don't think I'm too far off track here. I think this is probably okay. Right? I'm being creative. I'm kind of going with, you know, what I've got here. You know?
Other than she was told not to stray.
Right. But again, it's just like...
I see what you're saying.
No. Right? You know, and the main reason, again, is even though they were Nodites, you know, they had limitations that shouldn't be directly juiced, you know, by Adam and Eve. You know, that's why this is. It's putting too much amperage into the system to have them mate directly. And, you know, just because they were Nodites doesn't mean they could handle that amperage, you know. She thought they could, but, you know. They couldn't. That's why she was told not to do it.
She figured Adam couldn't handle it. She didn't mention it to him.
No. Anyway, right. So it's always, you know, these issues are not just arbitrary. They're literally physics issues. You know, like we've talked about. I mean, fundamentally, you have too big a discontinuity, you know, between the two, and so you have this huge differential that you're going to juice up. I mean, it's a little too much. It sort of tears the individual apart to put that much energy across that big a differential.
Might be different.
All those Nodites that birthed those children of mixed parentage died in the birth.
Yeah.
It was too stressful for
them.
Even that gap.
Right. Yep.
The result of the gift of the Adamic life plasm to the mortal races is an immediate upstemming of intellectual capacity and an acceleration of spiritual progress. There is usually some physical improvement also. On an average world, the post-Adamic dispensation is an age of great invention, energy control, and mechanical development. This is the era of the appearance of multiform manufacture and the control of natural forces. It is the golden age of exploration and the final subduing of the planet. Much of the material progress of a world occurs during this time of the inauguration of the development of the physical sciences, just such an epoch as Urantia is now experiencing. Your world is a full dispensation and more behind the average planetary schedule.
Yeah, okay, we were just talking about that. You know, the Revelator is alluding to you. You know, you just went through the Enlightenment and did some of those things that naturally are brought into play back in the post-Adamic age. Okay, at the beginning there, yeah, like we've said several times, remember the main thing that you're upstepping is the mind. Right? I mean, you have to upstep the body to upstep the mind. But the point is not just upstep the body. The point is to fundamentally to get the seventh adjunct to be able to engage more, you know, and just, you know, really uplift the whole functioning of that adjunct mind, get it to work together as a systemic phenomenon much more, right? Because the seventh adjunct is what brings them all together, right, into a system. Get it so that personality can engage it more and all these things. And then that whole acceleration, like I was saying, see that, I've been pointing that over and over again. You know, the more you can bring in spiritual energy, the more the developmental process can be accelerated. It brings in that geometric over that arithmetic normal progress. Okay, so there's, you know, it's directly telling you that. And then, you know, there is usually some physical improvement also. You just notice how secondary that is. You know, and on some worlds, you know, it may be the case that what happens naturally on the world is kind of not that different than what Adam and Eve bring. Right? And that's why I say usually. See, in other words, sometimes it really doesn't do much of anything physically, you know, sort of overtly. Obviously, there's subtle little things internally. But the basic physical expression is relatively unchanged. The humans are already pretty basically biologically material son and daughter-like, just from the natural evolutionary process.
It's on a normal planet.
On an exceptional normal planet is what they're talking about there. So it's really not, the main thing is not physical. And that's why at the beginning of the section they were reminding you that, I mean, don't undersell the evolutionary process. Evolution is creativity and time. Right? It's not some sort of, well, there's that evolution thing, but it doesn't, you know, isn't really that significant. No, I mean, it produces a definitive completeness, right? It's like they're pointing out sometimes, I mean, basically a material son and daughter like genetics is evolved, right? And just basically physically, there isn't any upstepping by mating with the children of Adam and Eve. And so, you want to not overplay that fiat-like stuff. Don't, the mother can do some profound things, you know, not just the father. Okay, so now then you've got, like I said, you've got the whole scientific agency. You've got invention, energy control, mechanical development, so science and technology. Control of natural forces, final subduing of the planet. Like I said, I mean, by 10,000 BC, if this had all happened, you'd have just like full ultimatonic physics and technology and everything. Right? You know, you'd be controlling the weather and everything. I mean, subduing the planet. You'd just be in total control of the planet.
Is this where they would have completed that fourth indispensable of the material comfort era?
I mean, that's the other thing. You know, you're also stepping along through those like we talked about. Yeah. Again, trying to, you know, because that really primes, like we said back then, getting the human choice in play rather than just doing what comes naturally. Right? The contrast of the material comfort era primes the choice phenomenon. Yeah.
Maybe they wouldn't have had to go through that if they would have been uplifted, if it would have been the true upliftment. Maybe other planets don't go through
that. No, that's the whole point of that paper on those developmental epochs. Every planet goes through those.
It's getting through it quicker.
Well, yeah, it all depends. But it's indispensable. I mean, if you don't have the material comfort area, you don't have the inevitabilities. That's how you have the inevitabilities, is by having the material comfort area. And see, and that's one of the things Caligash and Lucifer and everyone there are saying, oh, we don't need the material comfort area. Let's just skip over that. Let's go right to the age of spiritual striving. No. You have to, the only way to get the light in life is going through greed, tyranny, gluttony. Those are indispensable elements in the process.
So enjoy them while you can.
If you don't have those contrasts, you don't have any of the inevitabilities. Just go back and read them again. Is such and so desirable? It's just the way it is.
What makes us so different then? Just because all our eras happened in all different times.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally we're different because it's all jumbled up and way spread out over time, and yeah.
It's all happening together.
Yeah, some things are happening together that normally don't happen, you know. I mean, we have all this parallelism that isn't normally there.
If we would have had the upliftment, then it would be a lot different.
Right, we would have moved through that stuff. Right, we would have moved through that stuff, but we still would have gone through it, right? It's just basically all the things that we can imagine about a better future are all done in the post-planetary prince and post-Adamic age. Just remember that. You know, really, it is impossible for you to imagine really any, your most wildest dreams of heaven are pre-magisterial sun world, right? You can't imagine the stuff that we're about to read, you know, about after we get out of this section. Like they said, you really can't even imagine a lot of the post-planetary prince stuff. And by the time you get post-Adamic on a normal world, it's so completely, you know, you just can't even, the most idyllic thing you can think of is grotesque compared to what they're, you know, what you have on a normal world post-Adamic. We are like they're saying, you know, it. Your world is a full dispensation and more behind. Right?
At least.
Yeah, and that isn't just, remember that, that's not just the external world is behind. You're part of what's behind. You are very, very limited. Right? You know, you think you're imaginative and creative and stuff? No. Right? We're very primitive. We have no idea what adjective mind can really do. And if it was given the proper framework.
What about that genius pill or whatever it is that's out there?
Again, see, and humans can do these things where they try to tweak the physical system. But are they getting it balanced and uplifting it? No. They're focusing on one little part and accentuating it, which means it's going to throw everything else out of whack. All right, let's see, was there anything else in there? Notice they purposely said subdue, you know, just like in the Bible, right? It's mind made and personality managed. We are supposed to take a hold of the reins of the planet very definitively. Right now we're worried that if we have any impact on the planet, it's evil. It's like, no, the whole point is to have nothing but impact on the planet. Now, yes, you need to have wise impact, right? But just because some people have an impact that's unwise doesn't mean that we shouldn't have any impact at all, right? Notice we think in dichotomous terms, right? No, you're supposed to have nothing but impact. Now find the wisdom, right?
One of the tendencies of the bestial tendencies and paper, I think, sixth, or the evolution of the to human status was the mid mammals and that simian group. And I remember reading those three paragraphs, and it was like the thing that stuck out at me, it was an indifference to conquest. That's a bestial tendency. Mm-hmm. Indifference to in any kind of conquest, even conquest of mind,
right, right.
Over, you know, spirit over mind.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Good point to bring up. Because I haven't stressed it for a little while. Again, this Adamic uplift. Right. You have a relatively place-like nature until it gets uplifted. Adam and Eve, you know, give you a more directional nature through that upliftment. Gets it going towards purposes. Before that, you know, you have kind of a purposeless mankind. And that's why you see so much of that on the planet. You know, everyone is just kind of wandering in circles and going nowhere, right? You know, and if they do step on the accelerator and race, you know, you catch up with them at the next light, right? You know, I mean, you know, they have no you know, they're not thinking objectively, you know, just impulsive, right? They aren't charting an objective directional course, because most people can't. They don't have enough Adamic nature to think in directional terms. Sanghic mind is very place-like. They don't see themselves as the people of the future. They're people of the present. And they're just wandering around in the present until they die. Right? Yeah, good point to bring up that. You know, you're trying to get things activated so that there can be a definitive direction to mankind.
It doesn't say they had an aversion to conquest, like you see people today. They had an indifference, means they couldn't even differentiate what conquest was.
They just don't think
it was outside of their world.
Right, you don't think in those terms.
They just thought, you know, my home is pure. Yeah. Right.
I mean, taking the light and cultivating, you have to have a conquest mentality, right? It's effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, progress. I mean, this is a line you've got to work yourself through. It takes courage and stamina and foresight. Yeah. All right.
By the end of the Adamic dispensation on a normal planet, the races are practically blended so that it can be truly proclaimed that God has made of one blood all the nations, and that his Son has made of one color all peoples. The color of such an amalgamated race is somewhat of an olive shade of the violet hue, the racial quote-unquote white of the spheres.
Okay, so two things. First of all, playing off of the Bible passage from the book of Acts, you know, that first one, God has made of one blood all the nations. It's a fun one if you know the context, because the way that's actually being used in the New Testament there is the idea of, you know, starting with Adam and Eve, and everyone on the planet is a descendant of Adam and Eve, right, from one blood. So, but see, they flipped it around, you know, and having all these things going into one blood. But remember, because it all comes back into one blood, that's why subsequent to having that one race, everyone really thinks of Adam and Eve as the parents of all of mankind. So even though it's not in fact Adam and Eve are the parents of all mankind like the Bible says, in truth, Adam and Eve are the parents of all mankind. See, there's a truth to that passage in the Bible. And they're playing off of that by just flipping it around, that passage, and showing you the truth of that passage, even though the Bible was just stating it as a fact that's not valid. And then they tweak it, you know, the quote-unquote has made of one color all people. See, they just modified it. Right? I mean, obviously, in the Bible, they're not going to be talking about saying it like that. But you see, it's just a rewording. Again, how do they use quotes in the book? They're not quoting facts in the book. They're quoting truth. Right? You know, and they can take the same passage and reword it, and they're still quoting the same truth. Only now they've kind of tweaked the factual statement so it's more directly, you know, related to the facts. Because that's what you're actually doing, is blending the colored races. Right? You know, and not thinking so much in these bloodline sorts of things. But of course, Sanghic, right, the root of that is blood. I mean, they're playing off of our idea of bloodlines and just the coinage of the word Sanghic. Right? Anyway, all right, so you got that. It's just a kind of a fun example of leveraging off the Bible like they do. And then we talked about this before. Remember the quote-unquote violet hue, right? It's not a color. I mean, Adam and Eve and their children are just fair-skinned. Right? Basically, no color, you know, other than just some very limited pigment, sort of neutral sort of color.
Albino-ish?
Not albino-ish, but, right? Right. As I was saying, I mean, it's not colorless, right, like albino, but it's not, they're not a colored people, right? They don't have definitive color like even the Andonites did, you know, let alone like any of the six Sangiks, you know. So, you know, they just have a neutral skin, you know, that is the quote-unquote white. It's not literally white, it's not albino, literally, that's why it's in quotes, right? But it's quote-unquote white, the same way we use the word white. You know, and that's, you know, so you have a quote-unquote white stock, the violet race, on every world. You know, and so you get them blended together, the colored races, and they're telling you that you have something that ends up having kind of an olive shade to it. And then you throw in the Adamic, and it goes from a dark color to a very, very light color, right? The Adam and Eve, injecting Adam and Eve stock just, you know, washes the color down to a very, very light state. Like you take blue man, red man, yellow man, blend them together a little bit, send them into Northern Europe, you know, then send Andites in there, right? You take that basically brown man, and you wash it down so it looks like this, right? Where it's so light brown that we call it white. You know, and in my case, I have a bias toward the red pigment. You know, others in the room, you might notice you have a bias to the yellow pigment, maybe.
Mine's a freckle pigment.
yes. And then if it gets really, really washed down, we all know you've got those, especially redheads, right? You tend to have very, very fair skin. It's been diluted down. The color's been diluted down to where, you know, it almost is completely colorless, right? Yeah.
I would really like to see an olive shade of violet hue person.
Right. And again, see the violet, there's no color there. Right, there's no violet color. Right, the quote unquote violet hue is the white. Right. Yeah, remember the violet race doesn't have, you know, they aren't colored.
Chris.
Right. The reason they're called violet is because Adam and Eve glow that violet. Right. It's not their skin color. It's that, you know, that light that's being emitted by the interaction of the mechanical mind with their body. And that's why they're called the violet rays. There's no skin pigment. You know. all right. That's why they have that parenthetical in there, right? You know, just in case you had forgotten that there isn't literally a violet skin color. Yep.
They talk about the evolution of the Andites. You know, there's like, especially into India, there was waves, you know. And there was, like, I think the Adamites came first, and then the Andites, and then the Aryans. They called them Aryans.
Right.
Aryans and then Andites. And they called some of those people pre-white. Pre-white. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. Using that?
Yeah. Right.
So that's what I'm thinking, Adam and Eve, or maybe what you're describing. It's not really a flesh color. We, today, call white what we grew up with. Now it's politically incorrect. Flesh color crayon. No, I mean, you had it.
Right.
These people had to be pre that color, I think.
Right.
Know?
Yeah, that's the point I was trying to make.
More base.
Yeah, that was the point I was trying to make. See, that they, you know, remember that what we call white on this planet is blue man with some red man and some yellow man blended in and then washed down, right? You know. Right. The Adamites directly wouldn't have looked, it wouldn't have Northern European skin pigment. They would be that sort of pre-white, whatever you know, we can only kind of guess that it must be just very neutral and very light colored.
Well, maybe the redheads you just called, almost albino.
I mean, that's all we can really guess.
You know,
right?
Redheads do have a, a thing being charged up.
Yes, I mean, it's obvious if you're going to have those very fair-skinned redheads, that didn't come from Sangic stock, right?
Yeah.
That must be a very recessive expression of much more just kind of direct Adamic color.
Even the whole Tom Sawyer book and Huckleberry Finn, I mean, that's what Mark Twain was epitomizing. That's not politically
correct. All right, let's keep going here, yeah.
Primitive man is for the most part carnivorous. The material sons and daughters do not eat meat, but their offspring, within a few generations, usually gravitate to the carnivorous level.
Omnivorous
level. Although whole groups of their descendants sometimes remain non-flesh eaters. This double origin of the post-Adamic races explains how such blended human stocks exhibit anatomic vestiges belonging to both the herbivorous and carnivorous animal groups.
Why don't you read that next paragraph, too?
Within 10,000 years of racial amalgamation, the resultant stocks show varying degrees of an anatomic blend, some strains carrying more of the marks of the non-flesh-eating ancestry, others exhibiting more of the distinguishing traits and physical characteristics of their carnivorous evolutionary progenitors. The majority of these world races soon become omnivorous, subsisting upon a wide range of viands from both the animal and vegetable kingdoms.
Okay, so, you know, you may remember that's how we fundamentally got vegetarian peoples on the planet is being inspired by Adam and Eve. You know, and people remembering that, and you know, they're pointing out that's not exceptional. That's relatively common. Adam and Eve make a really big impact. Plus, unlike here, they stay. You know, and so for ages and ages and ages, you've got these individuals that don't eat any meat at all. So they're an ongoing inspiration for people to go that path.
That's what you have in India. Sethites. They became the first Brahmins of India, and now their race is washed out for the most part, but they still consider themselves Brahmins going back to Seth.
Right. So we all know we've got
vegetarians a lot.
We've got that influence here.
You do have the tree.
But of course, remember the tree is.
Different energy.
The main thing it's doing is, getting them connected into that energy input that offsets the normal aging processes. In order to have energy to, to do physical labor, they have to eat. With the non-breathers, right? They're actually getting the energy that they need, to go to the gym and lift weights, right? By that energy input from the master physical controllers. Adam and Eve, are not getting all of their energy intake like that. They're just getting this. We don't know anything about all these energies that are in the environment. But see, they're tapping into one of these energies that literally offsets the normal process of the life animation losing its relationship to the material body and you aging. So it keeps them energized. But the basic, in order to move their hand like this, right, they need to put food in their stomach.
So following up on this, what did Jesus mean when he said, "I have meat to eat that you don't
have"? that would be called a metaphor. using the parallel between material and spiritual energy. What was that?
Omnivore.
Okay, but... you know, this whole complex issue of, you know, you can see that it still is, it's sort of a, you know, an option thing. I mean, it's not like the those who are vegetarians are better, right? You can see that they're trying to make that point here, right? That there's nothing wrong with meat. And you need to recognize very definitively, like they're saying there, which, you know, some humans have figured out too by studying nutrition, that you've got these variations in mankind. There's some of us that you know, definitely are much more evolutionary stock-like, and you just can't exist without meat. Right? It doesn't matter how much you imagine yourself spiritual or something, and therefore you're going to be vegetarian, you know, where you falsely exalt this stuff. You know, you're fundamentally evolutionary-like, and you can't properly function without meat. Now, you might have a kind of a recessive expression that's a bit more Adamic-like, and it might be much more natural for you to go without meat. But they're trying to point out, in general, worlds are supposed to have omnivores.
Hear right? that, Brigitte?
Right? I
don't think she made it on.
Just, you know, see what's between the lines there. They're trying, because they know we get fixated on this. See, and it's one of those really prime areas where we don't properly keep the two substances separated in our heads. We start to think of matter as if it was spirit substance. You know, and we have these biases that go all the way back to Adam and Eve, you know, who we basically wanted to worship. You know, and so you see them eating just, you know, plant stock, and it's like, oh, that must be more spiritual stuff. Right? It's like, no, it's just matter. Right? It doesn't have anything to do with spirit. You know, they're just built that way. But you may not be at all built that way.
Jesus wasn't built that way.
Right. No, Jesus wasn't built that way. Right? Right. So they're trying to get us to be more objective and to definitely stop falsely exalting nutrition issues into spiritual issues. Right, it's not spirit substance. Right, you're making an ism out of it. You're adding a false spiritual notion to food. It doesn't mean that diet and food is not important, but don't try to make spirit of it. Spirit is a completely separate thing. And if you think that you're getting all of your spirit in your relationship to food, see, what are you actually doing unwittingly? You're biasing yourself away from actual spirit energy. You're making yourself less and less spiritual all the time. It's like, well, I think I'm more spiritual. Yeah, well, you can imagine anything. You can believe anything. But you're not really more spiritual because you're purposely turning your attention away from the other substance. You know, and an initial relationship to the two substances, they're opposite. If you turn and look at matter, spirit is behind you. You know, you're looking 180 degrees away from spirit. If you fixate on matter, now, they're trying to teach, trying to get us to not be so silly about this stuff.
But this is bolder.
I know.
It's become a breath area.
Yes, we all know this is problematic. But
if you're making more personal choices towards spiritual progress, you're going to naturally be attuned to more efficient ways to take care of your mechanism, and you know anything that. You know, in one unit that gives you everything you need and you know, kind of gives you a mild agitation, you know, for balance, the spiritual ministries can, you know, connect
yeah. with. You know? Yeah, yeah, I mean, see, just that was one more point I was going to make before we went on. See, just another thing that they're trying to teach you there is they know you want to be spiritual. They're reminding you, guess what? It may be the only way that you can actually get your mind in a balanced enough state to have any significant relationship to the spirit ministries is by eating meat. If you're a human that's like that, right, if you don't eat meat, you forget about trying to get that relationship with the spirit of truth and the adjuster we were talking about. Your mind will not be in a balanced enough state. So see, and no amount of imagining that your mind is in a balanced state. Well, actually put it in a balanced state. Okay, because your mind is attuned to your genetics, and if your genetics needs meat, right?
Yeah, it's difficult.
It's just the way it is.
Vegetarian things you need for, all the amino acids.
And all those, anyway, okay. So just, obviously that's a very loaded paragraph with all kinds of issues in some areas of the country, like here. All right.
The post-Adamic epic is the dispensation of internationalism. With the near completion of the task of race blending, nationalism wanes, and the brotherhood of man really begins to materialize. Representative government begins to take the place of the monarchical or paternal form of rulership. The educational systems become worldwide, and gradually the languages of the races give way to the tongue of the violet people. Universal peace and cooperation are seldom attained until the races are fairly well blended, until they speak a common language.
All right, so you got that big thing. Again, you can see how they're pointing out all kinds of issues we've got with this false aggrandizing of stuff. I mean, we want to eternalize every language on the planet. No, the whole point is for all languages to fade away except one. And normally, everyone just starts speaking the tongue of the Adamites.
Is that the tongue of Jerusalem?
No, it's going to be,
Do you have to relearn it? I mean, is it the tongue of the mansion rules?
No, it's not. No, it's not the tongue of Satania.
Okay.
Because each world is going to have a different Adamic tongue.
Why would that be?
Because,
they're different beginnings?
Right. I mean, because every world is different. The whole ministry is tuned to that world.
So the Adamic tongue, then, is what? Is it the one they come down and start talking when they first get here?
They don't explain exactly how this is normally, set up. Remember the way it was here, Van and Amidon had improved the Andonic tongue.
The alphabet.
And Adam and Eve had learned that. Right. See, so, in our case, the Adamic tongue would have been this improved Andonic tongue.
Mm-hmm. Which maybe improves over time.
Remember, Indo-European, the Indo-European language group has its commonality because of the Andites. I mean, unwittingly, we are actually evolving towards effectively an Adamic language as one language. English is Indo-European, right? So the extent to which English is becoming a global language, it's the essence of what normally happens.
Interesting.
Okay. The other thing there at the beginning, remember we got this, I mentioned up front, we've been going from tribes to nations with the post-planetary prince age. But of course you can fixate and you can get too ismy about nations. When they say that nationalism wanes, they don't mean nations wane, just overplaying it, right?
Right.
Thinking of them as an end in themselves. Because you can't have internationalism if you don't have nations, right?
And you don't have blended races.
Right, yeah. So that's the evolutionary process. You are with Adam and Eve, you have really objective nations now when they're all done, and then those objective nations can begin to interrelate, and have an international phenomenon on the world. And remember what I mentioned before. Once you have definitive nations, especially less ismized nations, the angels of nation life, can work with them. So it's not just Adam and Eve and whatnot, Prince and his staff, the Master Seraphim. Those particular Master Seraphim are going to have something to really definitively work with now. So those Master Seraphim that have been there since the Prince arrived, by the time you get done with Adam and Eve, all those different groups of Master Seraphim are going to start to become more and more in play. And you're going to start to have much more sophisticated expressions of those various aspects of human life that they're encouraging, you know, beginning to manifest. You're setting the stage for the magisterial sun, see? Now, so the master seraphim would be priming the pump to have that philosophic renaissance that the magisterial sun is going to launch. What else do we have there? Representative government. It is beginning to definitively manifest. That's a little reminder how long it took us to get to, how long it took the planetary government to foster the first really representative government on this planet. Normally that would have been way back there, BC with Adam and Eve. And the brotherhood of man really begins to materialize. Okay, that's very important, because that means there's beginning to have some rudimentary kindred minds. Okay, and that's all goes hand in hand. You think about what we were talking about. You've got everyone really having a nice complete bottom of the hourglass, so you're really going to start to engage the upper domain and get that consecrated to the one cosmos, right? That one cosmos allows all the minds to get on the same page. Extent to which you're attuned to the cosmos, you start to naturally have the brotherhood of man. So that's starting to happen. It's obviously pre-magisterial sun. It's going to be in a very rudimentary state. But nonetheless, just naturally, it's going to start to happen. Again, we don't have anything like the brotherhood of man right now because we don't have anything like a significant personal phenomenon happening on the planet. You can't have the brotherhood of man if there's fear still. And most of us have nothing but fear. Let's see, what else you have there? Worldwide education. That's, like I said, I mean, you're obviously going to be moving towards what the magisterial sun is going to do as the intellectual, philosophic uplifter.
Yes, they have something to work with.
Right. So you're getting this very unified education system going and everything. All right, let's see. They make a little comment about it here next.
During the closing centuries of the post-Adamic age, there develops new interest in art, music, and literature. And this worldwide awakening is a signal for the appearance of a magisterial sun. The crowning development of this era is the universal interest in intellectual realities, true philosophy. Religion becomes less nationalistic, becomes more and more a planetary affair. New revelations of truth characterize these ages, and the most highs of the constellations begin the rule in the affairs of men. Truth is revealed up to the administration of the constellation.
Okay, so now you got that last part, like we talked about. We have this, so we've gone from God and the big picture kind of being just up to the local system level in the previous dispensation. Now we expand it to the constellation level. But one thing that you might not remember about that is, we've had the most eyes ruling in the kingdoms of men, very definitively because of the rebellion and all that sort of stuff. But see, it's natural, too. And it's not just because of rebellion that you have, a most high observer in that sort of phenomenon, or even regencies. On a normal world, there are regencies where the most high observer manifests as the most high regent and takes over and definitively, gets the Ancients of Days Most High's fiat thing, implemented on a world, if that needs to happen. So that begins normally back then, see?
Well, maybe not too far back then. I mean, this might be before the magisterial sun comes, right?
Yeah, right. But I mean, back during the post-Adamic age.
10,000 years ago.
Yeah, right. I mean, just the post-Adamic age, on a normal world, no rebellion or default or anything, you start to get this imposition of a bigger, more objective picture imposed upon the people. It's less and less kind of just a natural evolutionary process. The humans are starting to take a hold of things. We talk about subduing the earth and stuff. Okay, you have free will, humans functioning much more definitively, and occasionally that needs to be injected upon, right, by the Most Highs. I mean, just because you've got all of this personal improved genetic character going on the planet doesn't mean the exercise of free will doesn't occasionally have issues. Okay? And so the Most Highs are there to deal with that. If the humans, through their exercise of free will, are going into territory that just you can't go there, they're going to insert themselves into the process, and that's not going to happen. Or if something needs to happen that's not happening, you know, quote unquote, naturally, you know, they'll see to it that it happens one way or another. So that's always there. And see, that they'll help you to understand Lucifer's mentality a little bit more. It's a universal thing that you've got these foreign, this foreign potentate phenomenon. Right? I mean, the Most Highs are acting as deputies of the Ancients of Days. You know, sticking their nose in other people's business. Now, what gives you the right to assume a regency on this planet? Okay, it's not just rebel worlds. It happens all over. See, and this really stuck in the craw, right, of these over-idealistic beings like Lucifer. Right, that want to, that think that everything should just come out wonderfully naturally,
from the bottom up.
Right, yeah, from the bottom up. Yes.
Top down.
Right. No, you fundamentally need some top down injection at times.
Seems like he was just too arrogant to think that he could handle it all and let everything proceed naturally.
Yeah.
Thought the impersonal forces would be enough to.
Yeah.
Recognize,
I mean, obviously, you know, he had a whole elaborate rationalization scheme in his head, you know, right? But I'm stressing this, is you can appreciate a little bit better just, you know, why this would have been such a big issue for him, you know? You may not have been thinking of it as being as universal a phenomenon as it is, this intervention sort of phenomenon. I mean, beyond the intervention of just having these sons coming and establishing these dispensations. See, this is separate. Right? Occasionally, these sons, the Most Highs, just insert themselves, you know, because their actions are transcendent of the dispensations. They have an even bigger picture than any given dispensation in mind.
You would think that as a system ruler, having had some 600 worlds, he would have seen this time and time again and been able to accept it.
Yeah, but he was really, really smart and could rationalize like we can't imagine, right? He just got himself off in this little eddy of rationalization where this all made sense to him. Mm-hmm. You know, remember, for a little while, until he's encircled in the Holy Spirit, you know, and there came a point when, oh, wait a minute, I'm stuck in a little eddy here, aren't I? You know, he pulled back, which the Holy Spirit objectivity allows you to do. Oh, I'm not in the hole. I'm in this little false part. Right? It seems like I'm in one turning, but it's just this little eddy. I'm not in the one turning. Right? And when he did that was when he didn't have the courage to admit, you know, he'd gotten himself into this, you know, this little
H-O-L-E.
this little circumscribed space, you know, and he started actively, you know, choosing what he knew to be wrong.
Though?
Oh, is that?
Don't we all do that?
Yeah, and we all, that's why they tell us about, you know, Lucifer, because we all have that tendency to do that. Right?
So talk about new revelations of truth characterizing and ministration only going up the constellation.
Yeah.
Whereas this book seems to go way beyond that.
Yeah, right. We talk about that all the time. How at the one hand, we're clear back basically primitive men, pre-planetary prince, and yet we're being given something that's post light and life in some ways, right? Okay, so yeah, we
makes you think.
We're a very interesting world.
They did what? And,
but another thing to focus on there is, remember, revelations are revelations of truth, not of fact, Right? So even though you're giving him a worldview that really tops out with the constellation, you're not giving him falsehood. You can give them truth, even though it's in that relatively small worldview. Right? Truth is, you know, doesn't demand that you have the entire master universe in the picture. Right? Truth is scale independent. Fact isn't, but truth is. Okay?
So would you envision that a lot of people whom we may meet in the Mansion Rules will not have as much knowledge of the whole universe as we retain it?
Yeah.
As we will?
Right. And,
would you?
Yes. I mean, they coming up from their world, they won't. But, of course, as soon as they get to the Mansion Worlds, you know, this is obviously, we've talked about this, this is not just us. I mean, everyone in the Mansion Worlds knows about this, too. Right? Everyone in the local universe knows about this. Like we pointed out, the whole local universe, it now has access to stuff that normally a local universe doesn't have access to until it's settled in light and life. You go to a neighboring local universe, okay, they don't have this, because that creator son is, you know, keeping this information from them. But in our local universe...
Why, you think everybody has it just because we have it?
Yeah, I mean, the cat's out of the bag. I mean...
For our local universe.
Yeah, in our local universe.
Even though we're isolated to some degree? Or
again, we're isolated in communication circuits, but there's people coming and going here all the time. Right?
But you can't look at that.
It's a good thing you can't read English.
I mean, for instance, just because this planet is in communication isolation doesn't mean that they can't have those human parallels the Marantia Moda that they're using on the Mansion Worlds, right?
Yes, sir.
No, the cat's out of the bag. You know, Michael has decided that this local universe is going to get stuff way ahead of its time.
How exciting for him.
And
for
us.
Yeah.
And for us.
Yeah, of course.
And think of all the visitors from all the other planets in the local system that come here.
Yeah.
And invited here to see what something really unusual and rare.
See what happens when you give advanced knowledge to really primitive people.
Yeah, you know. Living example.
But, nothing happens.
Yeah, anyway. I don't mean to make light of it. You know, I mean, it's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is a very interesting place for visitors.
Isn't the spirit of truth the mind of Michael?
I mean, the essence of it,
essence of it. So basically they have the essence with the spirit of truth without even having the book of what...
Yeah, but remember, Michael, the spirit of truth is just on this planet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, remember. And other planets that already had a bestowal sun.
They don't get that.
But the neighboring planet doesn't have the spirit of truth.
It's a sequence for them.
Yeah, they haven't even had a magisterial sun yet, let alone a bestowal sun. So, I got to make one statement here before we... on that one. Like I said, it's this the crowning development of this era is the universal interest in intellectual realities. True philosophy. You're building up to the magisterial sun. This book is building up to a magisterial sun. Yeah. It's beginnings of true philosophy. Okay, and you can have it at this age because you've got science now. Okay, Adam and Eve brought science, and you've got some rudimentary religion. It's a mustard seed. A little religion goes a long way. You can have an initial super additive consequence of some true philosophy manifesting on this world now that there's science. You couldn't have that pre-Adam and Eve, pre-science, but now you can have some true philosophy. And notice how they even worded it, this worldwide awakening. All right? That's also those 3 centuries, the 6th, 5th, and 4th centuries B.C., that's the awakening. All right? They had a little bit of rudimentary religion, and they've juiced, collected together some rudimentary science, really rudimentary, but it was enough to get some philosophy going, the awakening on our world. Now, unfortunately, once we got to the post-Enlightenment, when you had the potential more like the post-Adamic age to really get some significant philosophy, we decided philosophy was drivel and threw it out. You know, and followed the Enlightenment by the Endarkening. Right? And you now live in the age of greater and greater darkness, right? Instead of even yet greater light, philosophic light, to leverage off of that scientific illumination that we got in the Enlightenment. Now, that's why I have reawakening philosophy, you know, as a pair of seminars. Right? You've got the awakening, but it's gone dark, and it needs to be reawakened.
How long has it been dark?
Since the beginning of the 20th century.
Oh, no.
It started going dark.
Yeah. You can see that, what you're even saying.
Yeah. Okay, so let's finish it up here.
Great ethical advancement characterizes this era. The brotherhood of man is the goal of its society. Worldwide peace, the cessation of race conflict and national animosity, is the indicator of planetary ripeness for the advent of the third order of sonship, the magisterial son.
So everyone is looking forward to that. And notice, you know, there's kind of two different ways they express the same thing. In this paragraph, they call the brotherhood of man is the goal of its society. Remember, fundamentally, that means kindred minds. Kindred minds is the goal of the society. How do you get kindred minds? The previous paragraph, the crowning development of this era is the universal interest in intellectual realities, true philosophy. Right? That's sad to record. Almost no one on this planet has any interest, let alone it being a universal interest. Right, we were talking, that's how this whole group started, with what you were saying, Maria. Do you find there's universal interest for this book in my lap? No, because it's hard to even find a handful of interest in intellectual realities. This is not about fuzzy feelings, this book. It's about intellectual realities, not intellectual appearances, intellectual realities, and it's about true philosophy. Right? You're looking for the handful of people that are foreshadowing this time we're reading about, that are ripe for the magisterial son, despite all of our issues, right? That are hungry for a new worldview, a logical worldview, right? They're not content with their rationalization schemes and their so-called religious feelings, which aren't really religious feelings at all. They're just unity feelings. You can be hungry for true philosophy because you don't want to just be satisfied reverencing unity anymore. You now know the difference. You've recognized there's a difference between reverence and worship. Four levels of difference. And you go, I'm not satisfied anymore with reverencing unity and calling it worshiping God, like we always have been. I want to actually worship God. And to do that, I've got to go way up philosophically from where I am right now. I've got to start by responding to the philosophic impulse, the seventh adjutant. And then I've got to get up into relationship with the three cosmic intuitions. I've got to take the light in cultivating.
Don't you think Revelations helped you do that?
Yes, and that's what, you know, this is here for, to help you to do that. I mean, and if for no other reason, like I'm just saying, you should want to do that because you should want to actually worship God, not reverence unity and just anthropomorphizing unity and calling it God. God is not the anthropomorphism of God, of unity. But that's what humans call God. Our idea of God is just that. It's an anthropomorphic exaltation of unity. That's not God. That's why the book starts with, you need a better idea of God, and ends with a statement about the idea of God. God is not merely unity. Yes, God is spirit, but he's not just spirit. Okay? Unity is just spirit. To take on that challenge of seeking for something besides the appearances in your mind and how they make you feel, to try to actually get into relationship with reality, and it's an effort that is very, very difficult to do. The whole point of the Reawakening Philosophy seminars is to spend 60 hours trying to start the process. Right.
How many times have you taken it now?
Yeah, it's a huge thing to try to do what they're talking about here. True philosophy that they're talking about here is the superadditive consequence of the relationship between human philosophy and divine revelation. This is a rather large text. There's your divine revelation. That's a big challenge right there. But you got, that's only half of it. You have to combine this with an equally solid and complete human philosophy that was developed over 2,500 years of evolutionary philosophy from the 6th century BC to the beginning of the 20th century. You have to encompass both of those and then put the two together.
Basically that philosophy bootstrapped by the Andites.
Yeah. Right? So anyway, I don't want to belabor that, but just, you know, this is really speaking to, remember, why this book is in our lap. Right? With this book, they're trying to get us to this point they're talking about here. The closing centuries. Notice the time scale. Right? The magisterial sun is probably just a short time away, maybe a century, 2 centuries. Right? We're in the closing centuries, potentially, if you can do what I was just describing, of being ready for the magisterial sun. We won't be universally ready, but a handful can be ready. And so this is very, very relevant, understanding what this book is about. It's in your lap. It's trying to prime this point. Because the next sun, unless there's something really radical, is this next sun, the magisterial sun. All right, let's end it there. We'll get into the magisterium of the soul sons then next time, and see if we can try to wrap our minds around stuff that we can't imagine. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.